Hello and welcome to Dive and Dig, the podcast that takes you on a remarkable underwater journey. We'll be travelling with you down to an undiscovered world of our shared past, thanks to pioneering technology, and we'll be revealing some amazing archaeological discoveries once we get there.
I think it's all very exciting, I have to say. Jumping from the third millennium to the second millennium to the first millennium, each time period unveiling itself.
We'll be on location in Malta when precious finds are brought to the surface.
Because the piece is so well preserved, it's not attacked by teredos, by the shipworm. It doesn't have any encrustations, which means that it was buried pretty quickly.
And celebrate one of the pioneers of maritime archaeology, Honor Frost.
I belong to the first civilian diving club in the world.
So you decided you could cope with being underwater for some period of time?
Oh yes, the more the merrier, I mean, yes. Any time spent on the surface was a waste of time.
I'm Bettany Hughes, and this is the Dive and Dig podcast. Joining me from the Honor Frost Foundation is Director Lucy Blue. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Bettany.
Very lovely to be here with you. Now, Honor Frost was, quite frankly, the most amazing woman. Can you just tell us a bit more about her?
Yeah, no, she was quite remarkable. She was an incredible pioneer of maritime archaeology. If you think about the work that she did in the 1950s and 60s, but she actually had a former career as an illustrator and a set designer. And one day after work, she actually took her first dive. And here's an extract from the memories of this experience, which are quite remarkable.
There was 6 metres of black water above my head, and I sucked air through a mouthpiece, connected by hose to a pump on the surface. A full moon shone on the snow-covered garden, but I was no longer conscious of that world. This first crazy experiment reduced the act of diving to its essentials. My mind was confused neither by exotic surroundings nor the beauties of subaqueous light and landscape. For the baptism took place in a well in Wimbledon.
So that was how it all began. Extraordinary. How did Honor get from a well in Wimbledon to some of the most remarkable underwater sites in the Eastern Mediterranean?
Yeah, I know, it's rather crazy, really. I think this was a point of maybe epiphany for her. I mean, this was the point in which she redirected her career and decided that she'd take herself to the Mediterranean, where she actually learnt to dive in the 1950s with the earliest civilian diving club, alongside the likes of people like Jacques Cousteau and his team. And she went on from there to be involved with one of the first systematic underwater excavations, the Cape Caledonia wreck, this late Bronze Age wreck from over 3,500 years ago. And basically, this wreck marked the birth of maritime archaeology as we know it today. And she went on over the next 50 years to build this remarkable career as a woman pioneer maritime archaeologist, in predominantly working in the Eastern Mediterranean. And she was, you know, she was, I guess, obsessed, really. She was driven. And she wrote of the sense of escape she found when she was underwater. In fact, she believed that time spent on the surface was time wasted.
Amazing hearing her words. I mean, it's obviously quite a sort of sensuous thing for her. But just thinking about the technology of the time, because presumably Honor Frost wasn't on a length of pipe connecting her to the surface at that point, was she?
Well, I guess the fact that she'd had this amazing experience working off southern France with the pioneers, Jacques Cousteau, etc., gave her access to these early days of the Aqualung. And in fact, I'm about to go and talk to Jacques Cousteau's grandson, Philippe Cousteau, who is actually far more knowledgeable about the Aqualung and its development. So over to Philippe.
Amazing to remember that it was only about 77 years ago that my grandfather first set foot into the Marne River outside of Paris to test this new device that he had co-invented with an engineer named Émile Gagnon that would allow human beings to explore the ocean or any body of water freely. And until my grandfather co-invented the Aqualung, you know, the ocean was a thing of myths and legends, of krakens and monsters. And when he pioneered diving, essentially established, you know, created this valve. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's essentially the same valve that we use today in a regulator that any diver would use. And it's called a regulator because it would regulate gases under pressure and convert them to ambient air pressure on demand so that you could breathe them. I mean, imagine, you know, you can't breathe air right off of a pressurized tank. It would blow up your lungs. So this regulator would step down that pressure. And that was the innovation. That was this relatively simple invention. A big part of my grandfather's passion, particularly in the beginning, was underwater archaeology. And not hard to pioneer something that's never really been done before. So, you know, he had a passion for wrecks in history, and as he found them and helped to pioneer some techniques for excavating and exploring them, you know, he recognized that our history is so intertwined with the ocean. I mean, even if we've only been exploring beneath the surface for a few decades, we've been traveling the ocean for millennia, and the ocean is this great thing that unites us, this vast space that is a crossroads of civilization and can tell us so much about where we came from and who we were. And he had a passion for that, both off this coast of France and spending a lot of time off the coast of Greece. In fact, there's this famous scene in The Silent World, which was his first feature film, which won an Academy Award and a Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, where they're doing archaeology off the coast of Greece, and they bring up several amphora, which, you know, those teardrop-shaped clay containers that they used in the ancient times to transport oil and wine, etc. And several of them, the wax seal was still intact. And so they dressed up all in togas, the crew dressed up in togas, and they had a party, and they opened one of those amphoras and tasted, you know, 2,000 plus year old wine. Of course, it tastes like vinegar and it's terrible, but extraordinary time. You'd never be able to do that. Now people would gasp and that would be like, you know, sacrilege.
No, off to the museum, health and safety, off to the museum.
Yeah, exactly. Let's put it in a room somewhere. But back then it was all brand new. Nobody even really knew any of this stuff. The rules weren't written, and they were writing them as they went along. And so they had a little bit of fun with that one. And I think that was key to his sense of humor and the success of the films and the storytelling, is that they were willing to have fun and laugh. And that is something that, you know, is a universal emotion that everybody can relate to. And that was key to his successful storytelling.
Every day there was something new, something different. Imagine that was your whole life, wasn't it? Your grandfather's and Honor's to a certain extent. And she'd go off and have Volkswagen Beetle with the water dredge sort of wound up in the back. And she'd head off to Lebanon from London. I mean, it was quite amazing. But it was that sort of just not going to stand around and let life pass you by. You want to explore it and see every inch of it and make it happen.
We had a self-contained diving unit. We had a transit van, tanks or cylinders, as we used to call them in those days.
This is Bob York, who dived with Honor in 1970. At that point, Honor was searching for shipwrecks off the coast of Sicily.
More shallow water diving.
Here, Bob's talking about the early days of when they were actually doing the surveys to look for these shipwrecks.
The thing is, we didn't have mobiles in those days, so we had lots of scribbled notes that appeared from nowhere. And we met in Syracuse and made our way to Motia, which is near Marsala in western Sicily.
What was the daily routine? You were out on your boat.
We had a biggish boat, a big open boat that took us there, because it was a two-hour journey to get there. So we then decided the best thing to do was actually to do a systematic survey down the coast, from, you know, where in the sort of area where she thought it was. And we basically used four divers in the water with a tape measure and a line. And so we used to survey 130 metres out to sea with four divers, two either side of the tape. And we covered about half a kilometre, 500 metres of coastline, and found all sorts of exciting things. We found five possible wreck sites. artifacts, amphora, and we found a marvellous Roman anchor there as well.
So what sort of gear were you wearing? What sort of equipment were you using?
Well, we were fairly rudimentary single cylinders for us. And Honor, you know, as being a well-equipped lady, had a most superb twin set of Draeger cylinders, which was, in those days, incredibly expensive and not the sort of stuff that students would have. But it was very neat and tidy and very ladylike and sat neatly on her back. But the great thing about those cylinders, or tanks as you call them now, was that the demand valve actually screwed in with an O-ring, whereas ours were all with clips, A-clips.
So it was a bit safer.
Yes, I think so, and it was higher technology. It was good German technology.
Different times, different techniques, eh, Lucy? So thinking of now, how can we use technology to get even deeper into those seas?
Yeah, no, technology has certainly changed quite a lot since the early days. And essentially now we're using things like rebreathers and nitrox, lots of these technical terms. But I'm going to bring in my colleague and friend, Professor John Adams from the University of Southampton, because he has far more experience working with different technologies, effectively, advanced technologies. So I'll let John explain.
I think the rebreathers are significant because they've extended our capability in many ways. I mean, mixed gas diving, in other words, the ability to use different gases to actually go deeper and stay longer, have been around in the commercial world for decades. And depths of, you know, 250 metres or so are relatively straightforward in the commercial world, but not in scientific diving. If you're talking about conventional scuba where you're breathing compressed air, it's really 30 or 40 metres that's the practical limit, 50 in a lot of regimes in terms of safety. But as I know from my own experience, working on compressed air below about 25 metres, you know, the brain becomes increasingly affected by nitrogen narcosis. And although if you're just swimming around looking at stuff, you're not aware of it, it's quite interesting when you give a task that is technically different or difficult or requires a little bit of brain, a little bit of thought to somebody to go in 30 metres diving on air, and they'll come back having made all sorts of mistakes that they sometimes can't believe they've made themselves. And that's the effect of the gases. So the different gases give us the opportunity to work with a clear brain differently.
Well, I'm really delighted to invite Jane Maddox to our podcast. Jane is the Vice President of the British Subaqua Club, and particularly Jane's role in this is the Heritage Officer. I've known Jane for some years, I would say, Jane. but, I mean, Jane's just been... Well, you've been... When did you first learn to dive?
Well, it was 1971, so I've passed my 50th diving birthday. I was the only female in my branch for a very long time, and one of the things, apart from the fact I wouldn't take things off wrecks, I wanted to wear gloves, and apparently real divers didn't wear gloves in the winter in a 7mm wetsuit, really. And now I get into my heated vest with my dry suit, I slip on my twin sevens, I drop down to 40, 45 metres, and it's just, I have a computer on each wrist. I've got side mounts. I've got so much kit to play with. It's, you just go down there and stay and have a wonderful time.
You know, a lot of the people we're speaking to are professionals, but that there is a massive contribution that the non, the avocational, non-professional, I mean, in terms of maritime archaeology, they're often professional in their own right. They're the eyes on the seabed, and with some simple instructions, they can actually generate really important information and data. And also, that means about getting people engaged and involved and sort of passionate, doesn't it?
I mean, yes. Mm. It's another way of citizen science without making it overly heavy. But it is, the heritage doesn't belong just to one group of people. It belongs to people, And that's the bit that I'm trying to keep reinforcing, keep saying, you know, get out there and do it. And when we're actually looking at drowned land surfaces, when we're looking at wrecks, there's an awful lot out there. And we have a whole army out there who would be quite good at recording stuff and reporting what they found.
But the treasure isn't really the shiny things. It's the bits that give us an insight, isn't it, to the past.
Yeah. And people. I think for me, it's definitely got to be the people.
Now we've got loads of people diving. I mean, BZAC, the British Subaquatic Club, and many other clubs worldwide have, you know, hundreds and thousands of members. But then it was you and your male mates. It's quite interesting also thinking that you were the only woman in the club.
For a long time, actually.
One of the things that we need to remember as women is that the world of diving was, and to a certain extent still is, quite a male domain.
I mean, definitely, as far as we know, that's the case going right the way back to the Bronze Age, because we get these really tantalising references in the Iliad and the Odyssey, so Homer's great epic poems about the Trojan War. When we hear that sponges are being used, there's one section where the great god Hephaestus sponges down his forehead and his chest and his face, and then sponges are being used just to kind of clear up the mess on a dining table back in Odysseus's home. So I'm sure they were part of people's lives then. And, you know, there was this possibility as well of them being used to put paint onto some of the walls of early Cretan palaces, for instance. So sponges were definitely there in the culture, but we don't have any references to the divers being female. So we think they probably were young boys. Because, of course, they're doing that. They don't have any of this tech. You know, they're just putting a big weighted line down, getting down the line as far as they can, probably around 30 metres or so, staying down as long as they can, and then bringing the sponges back up to the surface.
No, it's amazing, really. And there are still parts of the world where that happens. I mean, it's not unique to the ancients. Technology hasn't sort of pervaded everywhere. We don't all have access to these amazing techniques. So, no, absolutely. And actually, the other thing that's really quite interesting is that a lot of the early shipwrecks, including the Gelidonia, were actually discovered by sponge divers. So they, you know, they've added their eyes onto the seabed and revealed secrets and then reported back to the archaeologists. So they've been a great asset and continue to be so to finding and discovering more shipwrecks.
Totally. I mean, through all the civilizations, I love the fact that... Could you remember, did you have a sponge when you were growing up? Or, no, you see, we did. I'm just old enough to remember this rather sort of horrible, skanky sponge that you had a new sponge every 5 years or so. But they were really like precious objects in the bathroom. And of course, the sponge was there in most people's bathrooms for around 200 years. But as you say, the culture in the discovery of them was huge. And I love the fact that when the Byzantine Empire becomes the Ottoman Empire and you have these massive sponge boats just kind of, you know, collecting from those islands off what is now the Turkish coast. And if you still go to those islands, some of their lullabies and drinking songs still involve sponges. So you sing babies to sleep talking about sponges. Yeah, or if you get really kind of ratted in a bar, you might burst into a kind of sponge.
Song about a sponge.
Song about a sponge.
I'm feeling deprived now that I didn't have one as a kid.
Maybe, Lucy, I will get you a sponge.
Oh, thank you, Bethany.
We can regenerate the tradition. Right the way back, as you say, they're kind of using really just raw materials and probably only getting down about 30 metres. But of course, now we can dive way, way beyond that. We can stay down a lot longer. And as a result, we can discover ever more remarkable archaeological remains of shipwrecks and submerged worlds. And there is one particular project that is currently exciting great archaeological interest. It's a shipwreck off Gozo near Malta, which I have to say, I had the privilege not quite to visit, but to hover above in a boat above the site, tantalisingly. I mean, it is remarkable, isn't it?
No, lucky you. I haven't actually made it there yet. But yes, I mean, it's really incredible because as archaeologists on scuba, we can get down to around 50 metres. But Timmy Gambin and his team from the University of Malta are now diving on a shipwreck that's 110 metres deep, which is slightly crazy. I mean, we're talking sort of the length of a football pitch long. He's diving deep underwater, which, as I would say, rather him than me.
Well, and as you say, that research team is led by Dr. Timmy Gambin from the University of Malta, and they're really pushing the limits of diving to reach the site so they can explore the remains of the wreck. And they are making some remarkable discoveries. Timmy Gambin, director of the Phoenician Shipwreck Project, is joining us now. Timmy, how lovely to be able to speak to you again.
Lovely to hear your voice, Beth.
Now, just thinking about this particular project, you've only got 12 minutes when you get down there. So I'm imagining every single dive is planned like a kind of military operation, planned right down to the last letter.
Every individual is given very precise instructions with regard to his or her tasks. And it is imperative that the tasks are carried out, not only with regard for the progress of the project, but given the depth of the dives that we're undertaking, also imperative to keep safety in mind. So there's the aspect of the tasks that need to be done in 12 minutes, and yet keeping the team safe.
And specifically, how do you prepare to dive at this great depth?
Personally, I like to keep calm, and for me it's imperative that I shut out everything else related to the project. This is a complex project, so for me what's imperative is to cut all of that out and focus only on the 14 minutes that I'll have on the seabed.
Well, sorry to bring you back to logistics now, because I'm imagining you there, shutting everything else out. But just in terms of the equipment that you can use, you can't dive on an aqualung at that depth, can you?
There are two systems that can be used by, let's say, amateur technical divers, which is what we are. We can either use an open circuit, so what looks like traditional scuba, but you're mixing, you're using mixed gases. This has its impact, because not only is it very expensive, because you're actually breathing, or the bubbles you're breathing out is helium, and you're using large volumes of it, but it also gives you restricted time and so on. So we use rebreathers. It's a closed circuit breathing system whereby the carbon dioxide that we breathe out goes through a scrubber, and the scrubber literally scrubs clean the air that we're breathing, so the CO2 is scrubbed out, so to speak, of the air, and then the computers on board the closed circuit system inject enough O2 to keep us going.
And what are the dangers potentially down there?
There are a number of dangers when carrying out this type of work. Primarily, if your unit, you're only as good as the unit on your back, so. If something happens to the unit, if it floods, if the computer fails, it's very similar to planes being flown on autopilot. The computer, the onboard computer of our unit, does everything, but it can fail. So we have a system of bailout. Each diver carries four extra cylinders. So if something does go wrong with our primary breathing apparatus, then we can bail out, go on to an open circuit system.
And you must have a system of communication, obviously. So if somebody does get into danger, or you know, simply so you can communicate between one another down there.
We have a series of hand signals. Standard hand signals that are used for technical diving. We have a small ROV, a small remote operated vehicle, which follows operations the whole time. So somebody from the shore is watching us work. So God forbid somebody had to bail out. We do have a system where we send up a buoy to the surface to say that, you know, a diver has bailed out and is in need of gas, for example. That would be the lime yellow boy. But this would have been observed by the crew on deck, so they're able to react even before the boy comes to the surface. So we don't actually have physical comms, so full face masks with sort of walkie-talkies, but we do communicate in these various ways.
What's the visibility like down there?
We're blessed that despite being 110 meters below the surface, the visibility is absolutely spectacular. Our dives take place more or less between 9 in the morning and midday, so when the sun is rising to its highest, and sunlight penetrates all the way down to that depth. So we do have extra lighting. We have a setup which we call the lamppost, not very imaginative, but every day we take a big underwater light that's been charged overnight. We switch this on, and this underwater light illuminates the entire site. Why do we need this? Because although sunlight penetrates down to 110 meters, the main colors are filtered out. Already, you know, when you dive down 20, 30 meters, you're losing your yellows, your reds. So this powerful underwater light brings the site to life. We're able to identify objects. We're able to distinguish. The shadows enable us already to kind of mark out whether an amphora has something etched on it or not, for example.
I mean, I've just been with you on the surface of the water there, and I could smell your excitement, Terry, because it is just such an extraordinary and unique place. But just hearing you describe the conditions down there, I mean, how do you... So you're operating, as you say, for 12, sometimes 14 minutes. How do you then get back up? I mean, because you're so deep at this point.
Well, it's the long way up. It takes us 7 minutes to descend. It's something the equivalent of a 40-story building. So imagine descending down a large tower block, 14 minutes on the site, and then 2.5 hours of ascending relatively slowly. So again, everything is calculated by our dive computers. So our dive computers give us the profile as to where our next stop is. Generally, our first stop is for 1 minute at around 51 meters, and then 48, and then 45, so on and so forth. The shallower we get, the longer the stops are, with the longer stops at 12, 9, and 6 meters. And that's where we have a lot of interaction with part of the team that don't descend to 110 meters, but are no less important.
Incredible. Will you come back on the next episode and tell us more specifically what you've been discovering down there? It'd be fantastic to hear.
It will be my pleasure, Beth.
Please, please, Timmy, stay safe. So technology not only allows us to dive deeper, but it's also allowed maritime archaeologists to locate, record, analyse and conserve the secrets of the deep, changing the face of maritime archaeology. And we're going to be exploring some of these developments in that next episode. And we'll also find out what Timmy and his team have actually discovered and what these finds reveal about a Mediterranean seafaring civilization that started to flourish 3,000 years ago. Join us again on Dive and Dig, a podcast made by the Honor Frost Foundation, the charity supporting maritime archaeological research right across the Eastern Mediterranean. Thank you all for listening. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.